The Center for Islamic Finance, and we've sort of long had a connection with the Jubilee Debt Campaign. So some of us here, me and Ryan, have been working on an ESRC-funded project for quite some time with an interest in debt and debt advice and debt counseling. And then we kind of, through Catherine, who happens to be here this evening, she put us all in connection with each other. So as a result, we're all having a conversation here. And our idea is to try to sort of compare faith-based and secular analyses of and solutions to personal debt problems in the UK. So we're going to try and have an interesting conversation coming from these different points of view. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Barbara Ridpath, the former director of St. Paul's Institute, and she'll give us a little bit of insight into a publication that they've got coming out very soon.
Just in case. Good evening, everybody. My voice usually carries just fine, so I don't think it's going to be a problem. I'm really delighted to be here this evening, as much to learn as to speak, because I think bringing people together from different positions on the same topic is infinitely more useful than bringing together people who vehemently agree. So my job is going to be to talk a little bit about our joint project and to discuss some of our conclusions in anticipation of the public launch on the 30th of January. Then Nathan's going to speak to some of the more Christian theological underpinnings, which are way beyond me, because I'm an economist by training, and we'll do the sort of geeky debt stuff. And then we'll move on to look at the Islamic faith approach, and then we'll look at a more secular-based approach, and then we'll look at the Jubilee campaign. So if you can see the sort of progression there, hopefully we'll stick to that. I'm particularly delighted that LSE's anthropology department is hosting, not only because we're very grateful, but I have three reasons. I think it's really good to see the anthropology department working on this and not the economics and finance department, because I think all social sciences need to engage in this topic, and we need to talk to each other about it, again, not just to ourselves. Similarly, this is an issue at hard about how we build community and work together for the common good. So it's terribly important that we talk across faiths and with different faiths, because this is certainly a case where we have much more in common than we do about our differences. And so I'm really pleased about that. And I think we come up with stronger ideas and better work for having conversations and trying to solve these problems across disciplines. So please don't think of this evening as an either or, faith-based or secular. It's a both conversation. Is how can we do better together, to me. And I have had, I was saying earlier, some terrific experiences with this around ethical finance with some work that's being done in Scotland on that. And third, I think it's probably appropriate, even though he's not here, to recognize that a member of the anthropology faculty at LSE wrote a book called Debt, the First 5,000 Years. That's David Graeber. And certainly our project is indebted to much of his work. I say that with no little irony. But the dominance, one of the things he writes about is the dominance of economic language in any talk about debt. And that's quite interesting. Our project is called Forgive Us Our Debts, an ethical approach to contemporary debt. And it grew out of mutual interests. For those of you who don't know, the St. Paul's Institute works on issues of ethics and finance in the city under the aegis of St. Paul's Cathedral. And Theos is an extremely good, I think I'm allowed to call them a think tank, on contemporary Christian issues. And we've worked well together in the past, and the current ethical issues around debt and dilemmas and what Christian teaching might have to offer around that was the subject for our exploration. Now, many of you will recognize Forgive Us Our Debts, even if it's not something you say very often, because it is a line from the Lord's Prayer. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Personally, I grew up with trespassers, but we won't go there. But many people repeat that when they say the Lord's Prayer, but not many people think about what it means. And not many people understand it, particularly, I think, as we struggle to understand the meaning because it's so contrary to current cultural practice. It's so rare that we're talking about forgiving and forgiveness when it comes to debt. So we were aware of the noise around many types of indebtedness, and this seminar is mostly around individual debt, but we felt we couldn't do just individual debt, that you needed to look at the interaction of individual debt, business debt, and government or national debt, especially because the more we studied, the more we realized this was one gigantic game of pass the parcel. And I will give you a couple examples. Austerity policies at the government level, including cuts in government benefits, might decrease government debt, but their knock-on effects in government benefit payments, cuts, and cuts in transfer payments to local authorities were causing individuals to take on debt or be subject to local authority bailiffs taking their belongings for non-payment of local rates. Second, government over the last 30 years has increasingly passed responsibility for what used to be public services to the private sector, particularly utilities, but also subcontracting, shifting the liabilities to the private sector that used to be public sector liabilities. Third, corporates increasingly use debt, the interest of which is tax deductible, in lieu of equity, which is double taxed, once on the profits earned and once paid out as dividends, in order to reduce both their funding and their tax bill. This results in a decline in government tax revenues, requiring the government to borrow again. Last of all, and perhaps closest to those of you in the audience who are still at LSE, is the student debt debacle. As an objective, increasing the percentage of young people who attend university sounds like an outrightly good thing. However, the knock-on increase in university funding from government became so significant that they opted to put in tuition fees and a loan program to fund those fees. This is a terrific example of the tug of war between who pays and who benefits in almost all government programs. I don't know how many of you noticed in the Brexit mess today that Lord Willetts, currently chairman of the Resolution Group, has acknowledged that raising tuition fees and charging interest on them was a mistake when he was university's minister in 2012. And he now thinks that all interest should be forgiven on student debt, cut to zero, and the government should reintroduce means-tested grants. I could go round and round on this subject, but I think I've proven the pass the parcel point. So how can we talk about how to face debt, let alone the redress of excessive debt, the damaging aspects of debt to individuals and societies, until we have an understanding of what we do want debt to do, what we don't want to do with debt, and how to think about it? So that's the first challenge. The second, beyond the obvious concern for individuals unable to function as a result of their debt loads, or the fragility of an economy based almost wholly on debt, is to understand why we care at all. Well, we discovered, and Nathan will talk more, I think, about the relational importance of debt, which has been largely forgotten or neglected in recent years, as debt has become impersonalized, marketized, driven by algorithm, available online or at the till without even speaking to another human being. Debt, in its best use, gives us responsibility towards one another and works towards the creation of community. David Graeber says that debt is just an exchange that has been brought to completion, and that in some cultures, people always ensure a bit of debt is outstanding so that the relationship is never extinguished. It actually helps to create community. So to the extent that we're working on thinking about how to strive for the common good, restoring debt to its rightful position in society becomes very interesting. However, the current widespread use of debt has distorted its original purpose at several levels. I'll give you three quick examples and then I'll pass over to Nathan. First, the power dynamic between lenders and borrowers means that it's almost impossible for a borrower to get a fair deal and a fair understanding of the product that best suits their needs, let alone a fair hearing when things go wrong. Second, debt has become so widespread that we no longer make a distinction between the gifts and forgiveness due to the poor and commercial lending, with all being expected to get by on loans on commercial terms. And third, and to me the most important, the growth of our economy depends almost entirely on consumer spending, itself fed by debt. This makes any government disinclined to want to curb debt to the extent it might cause a slowdown in economic growth. So the original intention of the project was to create a roadmap of questions that people could use to make their own minds up about the appropriate uses and levels of debt. Like any good project, we got slightly off track. And as we worked, our thinking evolved and became somewhat more prescriptive, starting with a series of small moves that everyone can make to be better informed, and moving to more draconian moves to actually change the current system for the benefit of all. I will leave more on this to Nathan, but do encourage anybody who is interested in hearing more about the project to look for the study when it comes out.
Over now to Nathan, is that the first one? Laden, who's a researcher at the Theos Think Tank.
Thank you very much. It's also a great pleasure to be with you tonight. So what I'll try to do in the next few minutes is to open the door and show you a bit of the sort of theological thinking that went behind some of the issues that Barbara brought out in her presentation. Really, what we tried to do with the project is to remind ourselves that debt and the economy more generally are fundamentally about our relationships with each other and about our common life. They are not just technical matters best left to the experts. Debt and the economy have an inerasable moral dimension. They are shaped and are underpinned by judgments about, among other things, what is the good and what is good for individuals, society, and the environment. What are fair and just practices and what are unjust, oppressive, and exploitative ones. So in the report, we try to review contemporary debt and discuss the main areas of concern within this ethical framework. And we derive this from Christian thought. But as I hope you'll see, and as I hope will emerge from this conversation, the principles we've arrived at are ones people of other faiths and no faith can hopefully get behind. Like any other aspect of human interaction, there are a variety of views and interpretations on debt, or as we noted in our report, a polyphony within the Christian tradition. But to push the metaphor slightly further, there is also a principal melody. It runs through the biblical text, the early church, the Middle Ages, through to the Reformation, and up to today. And it consists broadly of these ideas and concerns. First, when thinking about debt, the basic premise is that all people have intrinsic worth and dignity, as made in the image of God. Following on from this, there is a particular concern for the poor and the marginalized. This is absolutely central to the Old Testament laws, to Jesus's and the apostles' teaching, and is enshrined in the social teaching of the Catholic Church. There's also a recognition not only of individual wrongdoing and moral responsibility, but also of systemic injustice. Finally, there is a clear concern for the common good and the inclusion of all people into a common life. Now, let me unpack this a bit and just give you a quick overview of Christian teaching on debt. First, much of biblical language is economic and financial in nature. The very language of Christianity, forgiveness, reckoning, restitution, redemption, is shaped by economic practices and particularly about by debt relations. One of the overarching narratives in the Bible is about liberation from debt slavery. From the book of Exodus in the Pentateuch to Jesus's life on earth, release from debt bondage is a fundamental unifying theme that runs through the entire biblical story. In Christian thought, we came to the conclusion that debt and interest are not intrinsically immoral or sinful in biblical speak, rather they are morally ambivalent. At its best, as Barbara noted, debt expresses or articulates and strengthens relations of interdependence and mutuality between people. At their worst, debt and interest can be used to exploit and exclude people from the common life. Therefore, debt is best judged in terms of the relationships it creates between borrowers and lenders and third parties and within the wider society. Now, I think this is fascinating. An overwhelming part of biblical teaching on debt is actually focused on lenders rather than on borrowers. This explains the ban on interest or usury within the community of Israel and arguably later on in the church. And that is the concern to protect distressed borrowers from exploitation and abuse and correct some of the power imbalances. Jesus is an excellent case in point here. In the few instances where he talks about debt, he addresses the lenders, the creditors, the ones with cultural and economic power, not the borrowers. I find this very striking. In biblical times, just like today, lenders generally have more power than borrowers. Of course, this is not to suggest borrowers don't have agency and responsibility. They have and they do. But it rather shows Jesus is alert to the discrepancy in power between lenders and borrowers. And that's why he's addressing the ones who have the most potential to do harm and good. Jesus radicalizes the teaching of the Torah on lending and borrowing. He doesn't simply forbid interest within the community, as the law did, but encourages lending freely, gratuitously, especially to those in need, even to, quote-unquote, enemies, strangers, people whom you wouldn't normally have the bonds of friendship and of trust that obtain in the community. So therefore, lending in Jesus' teaching shades into gifting. He's asking creditors to lend, quote, expecting nothing in return, unquote. In other words, lend, he says to the lenders, expecting to never recover your assets. At the inauguration of his ministry and in the famous prayer, the Lord's Prayer, Jesus deeply identifies and echoes the principles of the Jubilee year in Leviticus 25, which prescribed the cancellation of all personal debt, the liberation of all debt slaves, and the return of the land to its original owners. And here's the corker, I think. When it comes to debt, the highest ethical principle in the Christian tradition is not debt repayment, but debt forgiveness. It's not pay your debts, but forgive your debtors. Now, of course, at this point, some of you will immediately think, is this what Christians are doing or should be doing? We don't see them doing that. Is this what they're actually saying to society? Others are probably thinking this doesn't make sense at all, and you're thinking of all sorts of objections. But I think the upshot for today, and this is what I'm bringing it to land, is not that all debts should be forgiven. When debt forgiveness or cancellation was practiced, and indeed it was, as economic historian Michael Hudson has quite decisively shown in a very recent book, it was only personal debt that was written down or wiped off, not commercial debt. Some forms of debt, as Barbara already mentioned, are good, are fair, are beneficial to borrowers and lenders. And the corporate sector can testify to this. But a lot of the problem debt that I think exists today, and we'll be talking about, no doubt, in our economy, whether it's in the form of council tax arrears, persistent credit card debt, is not fair. It's detrimental to borrowers and bad for the health of our society more generally. So the application rather is, and I'm being deliberately provocative here as I draw on the more radical strands of Christian teaching, I think as a society we should be thinking more consistently about applying the principle of debt forgiveness more often and more widely. That's not the only thing we should do, and indeed the report, as Barbara already mentioned, has a number of other applications and recommendations for ways in which we can fix the existing system. So the principle of debt forgiveness may strike you as attractive, particularly if you have family, friends, neighbors who are caught in unsustainable debt, but will also probably strike you as unrealistic. After all, what might be good for family, friends, and neighbors is hardly likely to be implemented across a whole society of, frankly, strangers. But that's precisely the point I'd like to end with. The principle of debt forgiveness and what we call in our report relational lending are predicated on solidarity and trust, or as theologians sometimes like to put it, relational proximity. Lending freely and forgiving those close to you is often hard and risky. But it is easier and more likely than forgiving complete strangers, is it not? Now, maintaining bonds of trust and solidarity is as difficult as it is necessary in a society. But I don't think there's any exaggeration in saying that they have been particularly weakened in our own. So if we stand any chance of taking the principle of debt forgiveness seriously and recovering what we call relational lending, we need to pay much more attention to and work together towards the mending and strengthening of these bonds of trust and solidarity. And with this goal in mind, there is ample room for dialogue and cooperation between people of all faiths and none. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much. So our next speaker is Mohammed Abdul Haq, Director of the Center for Islamic Finance, University of Bolton.
Thank you. I'm going just to share with you some points, and after that I will leave it for the Q&A probably. But in Christianity, I just learned that one of the praying is to ask to forgive of debts. From Islamic point of view, one of the main praying is to refuge to the Creator, to save you from the indignity of overwhelming debt. And the significance is when debt become overwhelming, there is an issue of indignity. It's not just a matter of inconvenient. It's a matter it will drive people to a very uncharted water in terms of their behavior and the rest of it. From one of the main strength about Islam as a faith is its emphasis on the concept of social justice. This is why, despite all bad things happening to in the name of Islam, Islam is still a popular through the prism of the social justice. You know, it is, i.e., people are equal. People have responsibility toward each other. And as a result, Islam emphasizes strongly on the concept of sharing of resources between haves and haves not. But I would like just to warn you to think Islam is a socialist. It's not, actually. Islam is, in fact, Adam Smith came with a laissez-faire. There is a saying for the Prophet 1400 years ago, when the prices of Medina, the commodities start to go up and up, people start to go to the Prophet, say, hey, please just fix the prices. And the Prophet, he's a well-known saying to him, he said, the only fixer is the Creator for the prices. So I will not intervene in fixing prices here. But at the same time, so this is where that balance, you know, so it's not a socialist. Is no, people, being rich is a blessing. Is not, you know, rich man is not cursed, has nothing to apologize. In fact, good luck, as long as he follow certain parameters and regulations or instructions. So, one of the other point, if I may, so there is, when it comes to finance, there is the main pillars of Islamic finance is profit and loss sharing. And the easiest way to understand the profit and loss sharing is it's basically a venture capital. Hence, for example, if you see, I think, I haven't made personally this study, but probably it's worth to be made, I think the default of debts, bank debts, is much higher than the collapse of venture capitalists' businesses. Because the venture capitalist, guess what? He has to live or die on the back of the return of this deal. So he has to think properly. He has to do proper due diligence, and the rest of it. Of course, there is another instrument from Islamic point of view. If you are a rich person, you have to pay, as if you are a Muslim rich person and you follow Islam, you have to pay something called zakah. Zakah is basically the closest to the Western mind is a tax. Basically, if you have if you have specific amount of money, and for 365 days, you have not, if you kept them ideal, i.e. in the bank, you have to pay 2.5% on them. If you invest them, you don't. So if you keep this, imagine it's £1 million. If you do nothing with those £1 million, in 33 years they will disappear. So as a capitalist, as someone on capital, it is of your interest is to invest in the society. So otherwise, you will be penalized by keeping your money ideal. And why I'm saying this, because why I think it's important, because it will create traffic. It will create investment in the society. When you are rich, you cannot just sit and inherit money and stay and do nothing. If you are rich, you need to invest in the society. And with all the consequence of investment, I mean the good ones. But the mother of all differences when it comes to Islamic finance is the question of interest. Interest is not allowed. And I believe personally the problem most people have, again, this is a general statement, need to be verified and need to be discussed further. But it's not from the debt. It's from the compound interest. That's the problem, you know? And hence, now you could say, what is the alternative? The alternative, again, from Islamic point of view, is profit and loss sharing. So people invest and they became stakeholders. And I'm still a banker, and I hope no one asks me what are you lecturing us about? But that's a different matter. But when bankers, they have a target to lend money. They have a target to bring deposit, and they have a target to bring money. What would you say to, again, it's nice to talk about religion and faith, but let me just bring it here, try to bring analogy with the day-to-day things. How could you expect when you go to one of those new lenders and you have £500 and you have to pay 1,299% return of interest? How could you, I mean, from Islamic point of view, that's unacceptable. From Islamic point of view, you are allowed to pay the management of the debt. So if I came to Nathan and I said, I need to borrow £100, he has electricity, he has time, he has this, he will say, okay, I will charge you 2.5%. And this is really 2.5 is specifically, you know, like some Islamic banks do charge these things. So this is basically, I do absolutely 100% support all efforts, because I'm a great believer. One of the things I love about Tesco is every little helps, absolutely, every little helps. But I really think the issue of debt, it has to be addressed through a proper ecosystem. It's not when someone, again, let me do some analogy, it's not when someone completely dying, we start to give him some medicine. We have from much, much earlier, there should be a mechanism to stop it. And this is basically another point. There is, I share with you, there is a concept in Islamic law called Maqasid al-Sharia, basically the objective of Islamic law. And one of the objectives of, basically, if you don't achieve those, there is no point. This is basically when you say the objective, which they are life. So anything to do with Islamic law has to protect life, has to protect intellect, has to protect faith, has to protect property. And I could say, you can't have life without dignity. And I could probably mathematically link debt to poverty, and poverty is a bad thing. I don't think anyone here is going to argue against it. Another point, which is also just to share with you how Islamic finance does not see money as a commodity. So money is a medium of exchange. So it's not a commodity. So as a result, you cannot charge for giving me the money. You can charge me for a service you have done to me, rather than for just I give you £5 and after that, okay, give it back to me plus whatever. So those are basically the main point, and I look forward to have more questions and answers later. Thank you.
Great. Thanks very much. Right. So thanks very much. The next speaker is Ryan Davey, Research Fellow in Policy Studies, University of Bristol, and a Visiting Fellow in Anthropology here at the LSE.
Thanks. Really pleased that this conversation is taking part. I'm agnostic, heavily lapsed Catholic, and faith groups perhaps not my natural habitat, but I'm very interested in this conversation, and I'm really pleased that it's taking place, because I share an interest that's been mentioned several times already about when does debt become oppressive, or when do debts become a situation of bondage for people, and to try and devise ways of identifying that, but also possible solutions to it. And I want to bring the idea of class inequality into our conversation. In an unequal world such as ours, both personal and state debt often increase levels of inequality. So in the UK, for example, we have what's called a poverty premium, whereby basically the less money you have, the more expensive credit is for you. So what can we do to counteract debt's ability to increase inequality? I'm trained as a social anthropologist, and my approach to religious responses to debt is to situate them within their economic, political, and social context, and also to try to trace their effects. And through fieldwork that I've carried out in the UK, I've observed that religious responses to debt, while also providing vital forms of relief and assistance to those with problem debts, can also sometimes inadvertently reproduce inequalities. So just to outline what I'll do in this short talk is to talk about one example in particular, which is the rise of church-based debt advice in the UK, and look at how and why this has happened. Secondly, I'll reflect on how inequality can creep in. And then finally, I'd like to suggest that by being vocal about this, secular and faith-based organisations alike can help to reduce inequality. So first of all, the basic observation that I'm starting with is that there's been a rise in church-based debt advice in the UK during the 21st century. Debt advice, you may be familiar with already, is a form of support, usually professional support, that's given to people who have problems with either financial debts, such as loans, or non-financial debts, such as council tax arrears or rent arrears. It emerged in the UK around the 1980s, and at that time, the template was for the government to provide funding to paid employees to provide this form of assistance. Starting around the year 2000, there's been a rapid growth and success in a particular type of debt advice organisation And that's debt advice that's housed in a local Christian church and often sponsored by or supported by that church and staffed primarily by volunteers. So Advice UK, which is the UK's umbrella membership body for independent advice providers, says that this has been the biggest growth in their membership in recent years. There's also been a new umbrella body set up specifically for these church-based debt advice organisations called Community Money Advice. It was established in 2001. They had two affiliate centres in 2003, and by 2011 they had nearly 100. So this seemingly and superficially traditional form of assistance that's staffed by volunteers often run under the roof of a church is actually one of the debt advice sector's latest innovations. Why and how has it grown? Broadly speaking, the reasons for the growth in church-based debt advice have a lot to do with changes that have taken place in the publicly funded debt advice arena, what I might call mainstream secular debt advice services in the UK. Since the 1990s, alternatives to state funding have been innovated in this in the mainstream debt advice sector, where debt advice organisations have tried to obtain their funding from the financial industry itself. At the time, this was quite controversial in the debt advice sector, as you might imagine. There were lots of allegations that debt advisors were selling themselves out to the financial industry and so on, and there were worries that by doing so, that debt advisors might compromise the integrity and impartiality of the advice that they're giving. But the form of funding became well established, and fast forward to 2012, and funding from the financial industry now provides the vast majority of funding for public-funded debt advice organisations in the UK. So these organisations are primarily not funded by the taxpayer, but by a levy on the banks that channels those funds directly towards it. What you find when this model of funding arises, and what I find interesting about it, is that this model of funding is almost always accompanied by a particular claim, and that claim is that debt advice can serve the interests of over-indebted people and the interests of the financial industry at one and the same time. So within kind of management level of the debt advice sector, it's received wisdom the debt advice organisations to try and find win-win solutions that benefit not only over-indebted people, but also the organisations to whom they're indebted. What's implicit in this is a belief that the interests of over-indebted citizens and the interests of the financial industry are fundamentally compatible, and in fact never opposed. This form of funding has had multiple effects on the ground, which I've observed through my fieldwork. So in 2012, when this new model of funding was introduced, I was volunteering a debt advice service, a publicly funded debt advice service, and they were virtually overnight subject to a 60% hike in their caseload targets, which meant that they had 60% more clients or cases that they had to process over the course of 1 year. The advisors that I was working with told me that they felt their work had become more mechanistic all of a sudden. They had to employ a kind of one-size-fits-all approach, and they weren't able, as much as they'd used to be, to tailor their service to the needs of individual clients. One advice manager told me that, in his words, it's changed so much that it's becoming unethical. I don't see myself staying around much longer. Another advice manager in London told me that a lot of the advisors that he worked with felt they could no longer exercise care and compassion through their work as debt advisors. Some advisors were signed off work with stress because they just found it too much of a strain. And in the midst of this, this kind of newly emergent model of church-run, volunteer-staffed debt advice seemed to provide an alternative to a lot of these problems. Advisors felt they could spend more time with clients who needed it, they could exercise greater amounts of care and compassion, And it was felt to be especially well suited to those clients with the greatest needs. So many clients with mental health problems who perhaps were unable to help themselves quite as much, clients seen as being vulnerable or poor and needy. Many of the clients I spoke to indeed felt that this had been a vital source of support for them, and it wasn't unusual for the clients of these debt advice services to tell me that they'd been contemplating suicide, and without the assistance of this church-based support, they may well have attempted suicide. So it provides, as I say, a very vital form of support. So I want to return to the question that I posed at the start. How does inequality creep into this form of support? As I've said, in 2012, mainstream debt advice funding came to be funded primarily by a levy on banks. And this was accompanied by a claim that debt advice serves the interests of creditors and debtors at one and the same time, and so that these interests are fundamentally compatible. The new church-based model of advice seems to be giving the appropriate form of support to people who need it, and especially those who have the greatest need. And you might well conclude, like, what alternatives are there in a situation where funding has been reduced for debt advice services? But I would also observe that it cordons off those people who are not well served by mainstream debt advice. And this cordoning off of the more vulnerable or more vulnerable clients or those who have the greatest need allows the mainstream publicly funded debt advice sector to carry on saying that the interests of indebted citizens and the interests of the financial industry are never opposed. This claim glosses over multiple forms of financial exploitation, and by the term financial exploitation, I simply mean forms of debt relations where rich people get richer and poor people get poorer, so types of debts that tend to increase inequality. Churches have been helping those people who need more time, care and compassion in order to resolve their debt problems. But we should also remember the larger scale processes that have created this need in the first place, and they include deindustrialization, a decline in the real value of wages, an increase in part-time insecure work, a transfer of capital from public ownership into private hands, including through the creation of sovereign debt bonds, the poverty premium that I mentioned earlier, and austerity cuts to welfare, often in the name of state debt repayment, which reduce people's access to essential goods. So now that it's so well established, perhaps the church-based debt advice sector can be more vocal in taking both the financial industry and the mainstream advice sector to task and question some of its assumptions about the effectiveness of so-called efficiency measures, assumptions about whether you can always find win-win solutions, and assumptions about whether the interests of creditors and debtors are never opposed. And the financial industry's role in reproducing inequality goes far beyond simply a case of a few bad apples, as with payday lenders and the like. In fact, there is a systemic tendency in the credit system we have to extract wealth from the bottom and channel it towards the top. By channeling this tendency, we can counteract rather than reinforce the tendency of debt to perpetuate inequality. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Ryan. Okay, and finally to wrap up, we have Tim Jones, a policy officer at the Jubilee Debt Campaign.
Hey, thank you. It's great to be here with you tonight. Often, at the start, I have to explain where on earth the name Jubilee Debt Campaign comes from and how we're actually nothing to do with the Queen or celebrations of her birthday. We've already had, thankfully, tonight, the mention of the word Jubilee as being a word from the Hebrew Scriptures, a time to cancel debt. And that is how we originated the campaign to cancel debt of developing countries for the millennium. This doesn't mean that we see debt as a bad thing. We very much are in line with seeing debt as a potentially very positive thing, a way to invest for the future, whether that's for companies or governments or individuals, and a way to deal with short-term financial difficulties until then a situation has improved and debts can be repaid. Those two things can obviously both go wrong if the investment fails or if a short-term problem turns out to actually be much more ongoing. The problem that we were created to tackle was that of developing countries who got into big debts when the prices of commodities fell in the 1980s. These are raw materials and the main thing that countries exported. And a lot of debt was created to respond to this temporary problem as it was seen. But the prices of these raw materials stayed low for the next 25 years. And so what initially thought to be a temporary crisis turned out to be permanent. And that can be across the board for all debt situations. If loans are in response to what's seen as a temporary fall in wages, a temporary increase in unemployment, but then actually a longer process is created. And so we very much agree that debt can then be used as a tool of exploitation. And this example of those who are in most in need paying the highest interest rates also works across the board. We see it with individuals here in the UK, and we see it in international finances. The UK government at the moment can borrow for 10 years at 1.2% interest fixed in its own currency. The Ghanaian government can borrow at 8% interest in a foreign currency that it does not control. When debt problems do arise, we see that this relationship that debt is between the borrower and the lender, then the focus tends to be put just on the borrower. In recent years, we've seen this with the crisis in Greece, where all the media coverage was around the problems created by the Greek government, none by the people who'd lent the money originally. The Jubilee Debt Campaign originated in the 1990s as both a faith-based and secular campaign calling for the debts of 52 countries to be cancelled. And the fact we have Jubilee in the name shows that we had lots of faith input. We had lots of people, particularly from the churches, but also organisations like Islamic Relief and the Jewish charity Zedek were at the heart of the campaign. But also trade unions and secular organisations were involved. And it had a huge impact that debt was one of the biggest challenges facing many of the countries in the global south through the 1980s and 1990s. Following the campaign, we did not get everything we wanted, but $130 billion of debt was cancelled for 36 countries, which had a huge impact in enabling much more spending on health and education and liberating many countries from a debt burden that had been there for 20, 25, 30 years in some cases. I just want to reflect on three things of that campaign that I think also relate to debt in the UK, particularly personal debt, but other kinds of debt as well. One is quite clearly that social movements acting together, both faith-based and secular, can have a huge impact in putting an issue on the political agenda and getting change. The Jubilee campaign raised this issue that was of huge global importance but getting very little coverage to something that was seen as globally important. It was done, one of the frustrations I have in talking about the campaign is if people have heard of us, often they might say, oh, that was what Bono was involved in. I have big problems for that because my memory is the first protest I went on was with my church in 1998. We went to Birmingham. There were 80,000 people on the streets of Birmingham. That was before Bono was seen as having involved. And there are people across churches across Europe who went on to Cologne the next year, to Genoa, to Edinburgh. 21 million people signed a petition across the world. So it was this big movement of people, not just a few celebrities talking about it. And it was persistent campaigning. There was a story of one of the things that the campaign did was send pound coins to Gordon Brown when he was the Chancellor, as a way of saying, I want this to be my contribution to cancelling the debt. I don't think that this is a debt that I'm part of. One of the people who sent a coin to him was his mum. So we can work together, we can get change. And then secondly, this challenging the morality of debt, that debt can be cancelled or regulated or changed. We have, particularly for individuals and governments, a huge moral pressure is put on them that debt must always be paid. And I think it is vital, and one of the things that faith organisations can bring is challenging that morality and saying actually the morally best thing sometimes is for debts not to be paid. One of the things that the campaigners in the Global South said during the campaign was actually challenging this use of the forgiveness. Because for them, if you're from, I would say, the Democratic Republic of Congo, loans were given to General Mobutu, a dictator, through the 70s and 80s by the Western world to prop him up during the Cold War, knowing that that money was being stolen. For somebody in the Democratic Republic of Congo, to say forgive us our debt is just outrageous. It's not a debt that they feel they've had control of, and it's not them who need to be asking for forgiveness. It's the people who lent the money and propped up Mobutu who need to be asking for forgiveness. And I think another word that was used is liberation. Liberators from our debts. This thing has gone wrong. Let's change it to get to a better situation. In the UK, we're seeing some interventions in the personal debt market. We now have a cap on the cost of payday loans. And possibly rent-to-own loans. We, as Jubilee Debt Campaign, have expanded our work. So we are now a part of, with other organisations like the New Economics Foundation, campaigning on personal debts in the UK. And one of the first things we're saying is to extend this cap on the cost of credit across all forms of lending so that nobody ever has to pay back more than twice what they borrowed. It's not yet as the same as there being no interest, but every little helps in getting there. But then finally, probably the thing most challenging, especially for us with having debt in the name, is that debt is ultimately a symptom, not the cause of the problem. The debt cancellation that we got for countries in the Global South did help massively, but many of them are now heading back into the same debt crises again. Because fundamental reasons why they're in crisis were to do with this things like dependence on raw materials as the basis for their income from the rest of the world. And so as long as those structural things do not change, then the debt problems will keep on arising. For personal debt in the UK, where it's the most problem, it arises because of low wages. Wages are still lower now than in 2008, precarious work, welfare cuts. And so these are the underlying issues that mean that then personal debt problems grow. Or in a slightly different way, one we've not mentioned so much, like government debt in the UK. I would argue there the issue is not really about debt. The real issues are the need for progressive taxation to fund public services at a time of an ageing population. And also on the flip side, the chronic lack of investment in various things in the UK, from housing to transport to energy, alongside the fact that the government can borrow in the UK at such cheap interest rates. And these are the real issues we should be talking about to do with government debt, not just simply talking about debt to GDP. So finally, to sum up, debt can be good, it can be bad. We need to morally challenge against debt when it is being used as a form of exploitation, as one of the ways to build a common good as part of many other things to challenge these problems. Thank you.
Thanks very much. So we're initially just going to find out if any of the speakers would like to respond to things they've heard each other say. And then we'll, after that, we'll open the floor to questions. Anybody got any ideas or responses?
I have a slightly minor point, which is I'd like to take issue with the venture capital point.
Please do.
And I think in principle you're right, but in practice most venture capitalists have made out very well, But they've made out very well by loading these companies with debt and using that debt to take multiple times the profit of their investment, at which point they leave the company bankrupt and the employees out of work, but they've walked away with 900% on the return on their investment. Now, that's not always the case, and there are funds that do very well and very ethically, but certainly in recent bankruptcies, where the investors have largely been VCs, Toys R Us is one, they walked away, they got more than all their money back, and then some. And so I think
you're talking about private equity.
Fair point, fair point, fair point, you're right. Mistaken term. But there is there's a difference between the two. You're absolutely right, Paul. But I do worry about people always presuming that these guys are doing the right thing.
I definitely, I didn't use venture capital probably accurately. I think I was referring to more private capital. But the point I was trying to make is the lender should be a stakeholder in the transaction rather than just I'm happy to lend today and whatever happened tomorrow, someone else's problem. So yes, I mean, I'm aware of. Yeah. They are not my. I don't have photos for the venture capitalists, not at all. And there's a lot of horror stories, but it is that dynamics where I was referring to private equity, venture capital. Again, this is a very loose expression.
Fair enough. Absolutely
but
fair.
But no, I'm happy to. I don't have anything to disagree with you. Not at all. Not at all.
So if I could just ask a question again from to some of you who've spoken here. It strikes me from my own studies on debt that what seems to have really exacerbated things quite a lot in the very recent time is this much more automated character of debt, which I think you were mentioning at the beginning. So many of the things all of you have been describing relate to sort of notions of ethical connections between individuals seen as very personable people in interaction, but it seems as if many of the kind of most egregious forms of indebtedness seem to come about in scenarios where people just get to take your money straight away from your bank account without actually interacting with you at all. And then in those kinds of settings, it seems as though the faith-based arena is often one where money gets used to sort of help those who are most in need, as Ryan was pointing out there. And I myself have been observing some kind of interactions in a Muslim association in North London where, again, people who have wealth are putting it into these kinds of initiatives to try and help those who are very poor. But I wonder whether, you know, faith can do something beyond that, just sort of helping those who are in a particularly bad situation. Can it extend into this much broader public arena and combat some of these much more machinic and kind of, automated forms of indebtedness and credit and so on, which ultimately seems to be all about making people further apart and making people much more unequal? I don't know if that's the thing that has an answer, really, but...
I'm not sure I have a solution. In fact, I know I don't have a solution. But one of the things we really debated as we were writing was this concept of the old-fashioned banker who knew you and lent you money and wasn't that nice. But we forget that in those days, most people couldn't access credit. Right, so there was a rationing of credit, and only the most well-to-do could access that credit, and usually by mortgaging their house. And so there was a trade-off. There's a very interesting ethical trade-off to me between who are we to tell people they shouldn't be able to have credit because it may be a hardship for them, and going back to an old-fashioned system where only those who were good friends with the banker got the money. You know, and so I don't know the right answer, although I do think, and one of the things that's not a panacea, but that we're seeing in some of the tech companies, is some very good budgeting tools that, you know, that don't help the most destitute who can't meet their end of week, and, you know, that's not going to help them. But I see it particularly among, I will be honest, my own children, you know, where they put a certain amount of money on the card. And that's all they can use. It's kind of like before there were cash machines and you had to get your money out for the weekend. You may not remember that, but I do. You know, you actually, it teaches you to use only what you can afford to use.
Yeah. But any other responses from any?
I've got an additional problem as well, that we've been talking about borrowers and lenders, but often the owners of the debt are not the people who lent the money originally. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly true with government debt, that most of the time the cases we're working on, the people who now own the debt have bought it, often far more cheaply than the face value. And as this grows within personal debt markets as well, it offers another challenge to relationships. I think it potentially offers another opportunity in terms of how we tell the story. Because if you have the person who's claiming a debt is owed that paid 3 pence for a £1 worth of debt, and you can get that story out there, it changes how that debt is then conceived. And I think too often, again, this moral pressure of debt, people don't realise, I mean, certainly when it gets to the level of bailiffs, that we've got the debt recovery companies will have paid a tiny amount for this debt, but the people who are being threatened by them don't know that and still have this moral value of this huge amount that is way beyond what the debt recovery company paid for it.
Yeah. Okay. I think there is a serious issue, not just, again, it can't be just only you go to the debt. You need to go to the wider picture. For example, when a company here just give a notice for its employees for 1 month, for example. Some European countries, you need to have to pay a year or 2 years, like, for example, in Germany. And we keep saying, oh, our economy is more competitive. I'm not sure our economy is better than the German economy, by the way. So I don't think, so we have those terminologies we keep using. I think usually the burden is in the stronger side of the equation, not in the weaker side. So i.e. when someone give a loan for £5,000 to someone's salary is £100, this guy who lent £5,000 need to be ready to lose.
Yep.
And that should be embedded in the law. I just have a point, if I may mention, regarding your analysis about why third world countries, they are always in debt. Definitely one of them is what you said. But please don't ever underestimate corruption.
Yeah, but
corruption.
I could go on paper then, maybe.
But it's not just only about raw materials. It's about corruption. Yeah. And I think corruption is much worse, in fact, than the raw materials question. And again, I know it's debatable, but the IMF recipe, for prescription for certain countries, 2-3 corruption transactions could have solved the issue. But no one is,
I have a
question.
Just for the others, in terms of debt forgiveness, I'm convinced by all the arguments in favour of it. They're very persuasive and I'm very kind of behind calls for various kinds of debt forgiveness. I wonder if would also be in favour of arguing in favour of the legitimacy of debt refusal. So situations where we've concluded on the same basis that the debt is unjust, but that no one kind of from above has forgiven or cancelled the debt. Would we agree that it's legitimate for the debtor in that case, without any authorization externally, to simply say, I'm not going to pay this because I shouldn't have to?
Any ideas on that one?
There's some talk about doing that on UK student debts. People just wholesaling, stop paying. I'm not promoting that here, just in case. But it is something that we talk about a bit in the paper, because it is something that there would be enough power in the students as a movement to at least consider.
So should we bear that in mind? And just conscious of time passing by, let's open up the floor and see if we can take a few questions, and then perhaps we can come back to these issues. So, So any questions? I'm going to take them in groups of three. So here's one over here. Thank you. We've got a microphone coming over.
Two very related questions. So,
say your name as well.
My name is Andrea. So if forgiveness is not accompanied with solving the underlying problems, don't you create a moral hazard that people just... there seems to be, regarding moral hazard, there seems to be a different perception of it between, let's say, Catholic and Protestant faiths. Is that a misconception, or is if there is a difference, what's the historical source of that?
Okay. Any other questions? There's one up here. Thank you.
So I just want to pull you all up. My name is Colin. I know Ryan. Ryan spent some time in placement with us in Plymouth. So a couple of assumptions you've made on the panel, which I just want to pull up a little bit, if that's okay. Firstly, just to pick up on that last point around the OFT had, the Office of Fair Trading had something around extortionate credit. And so people had to take the creditor to court to decide what was extortionate. And it got to a point where little old individual took on lawyers, and so extortionate became, it had to be extortionate, which was a ridiculous position to get in, which then closed the door on other people. So the government came along behind that and created something called the Unfair Relationship Act, or thereabouts, which gave us more opportunity to go back and challenge relationships. But the reality is that still doesn't address all of these issues. So that's just one aspect. I want to pick up on the point you made about... credit and the availability of credit as well. So Provident Financial is a well-known organisation, top FTSE 250 organisation. I think they've been around a long time giving credit to individuals well beyond the realms of what you were suggesting, and so have many other organisations in that space, and making quite a handsome price at times as well out of it. And I just want to pick us all up on something else as well. So we talked about debt relief. Actually, we used to do debt relief in this country on a micro scale. We called it the social fund, where we used to give community care grants to people. So whatever happened to community care grants? So here we are, forgive me, pontificating and discussing, quite rightly so, but the reality is we've let some of these things disappear off the horizon, and actually we should be not quite marching on the streets about these things, but actually if we have any interest in the poor, in inverted commas, and inequality, then frankly we've let these things go on our watch, and that's to our all discredit.
Right, so that's already more than three questions. So I think I might just get you guys to reply quickly before we take the next one. Anybody want to address either of those?
Yeah, I'm happy to talk to the issue of moral hazard. Obviously, this is this comes up when it comes to debt forgiveness / debt cancellation. Well, first of all, I'm not prescribing any particular way in which the principle might be applied. It doesn't necessarily have to be wholesale forgiveness, but a writing off of debt, a way of saying you don't have to pay the whole amount. But I would say more importantly, I think I wouldn't underestimate what having that burden unloaded from you can do to you. I think we're seeing the effects of this legalistic framework and what it does to people, and what it does to kind of the relations in the wider society. I think it's worth a punt. That sounds quite risky in a sense, but I think there's some economic analysis that can be done about what the effects of the principle of debt forgiveness could look like. In fact, the book that I referenced, Michael Hudson, who shows quite convincingly that during the Bronze Age and ancient Near East, debt forgiveness, debt cancellation was practiced widely and systematically. You would have new rulers who, when they would come to the throne, the first thing they would do, they would clear the slate, basically, and give a fresh start. There's no indication that completely threw the economies into chaos. In fact, it liberated a number of people. So I think, plus in our system, if you cancel the debts today, you still have the question of credit score. That doesn't go away. So unless that also is removed, and there would be some debate about what alternative system you put into place, there would be a record that your debt had been cleared. So I think moral hazard is really not the heart of the matter, although it should be taken into account. And this is where I was trying to show individual responsibility is hugely important, but we shouldn't be neglecting other structural factors and forces at play.
Thanks. Anybody want, yeah?
Just got another point on moral hazard, that I think moral hazard is a point, but it's the hazard of the lenders. So when a crisis arises for a government, the standard response is for people like the IMF, or in Greece's case, the EU, to lend more money, which pays off the people who lent originally, and so they escape, and there's the moral hazard that means they can keep lending recklessly in the future. And for individuals, the more systems we have that ensure that exploitative loans are repaid, the more it incentivizes them to continue. So we do need to challenge moral hazard, but debt cancellation is a way of doing that, that it can reset the balance more, because you've got to find a balance somewhere between borrowers and lenders. And at the moment, in so much debt, it's weighted too much towards the lenders always being the ones backed up and getting away with recklessness, and then they continue doing it.
I'll
do a very quick on private and financial, but basically because I want to ask you a question about it, because I've always been very discomforted by that company, because I actually know somebody on their board who thinks they're providing a service, a really, really fundamental service to people who otherwise couldn't get credit. And I can't get my head around that in the same way. I don't know why, and I'd be curious where you come out on it. But I can say, just historically, those were tiny compared to the total credit in the economy, and now the amount of consumer credit in the economy is huge. So they did exist, but they did not fulfill anywhere near the kind of demand that is being fulfilled today. But what do you think of them?
Well, let's code that for a second. We can maybe talk about that at the end. Do you want to specifically
answer
this?
I just want to go to Colin. I personally think there is no way to solve the question of debt without government intervention. Government has a big role to play, and of course, they will welcome all initiatives. But just an example of universities, one of the criteria to get funding is about student retention. I think the financial reporting shouldn't only be about for banks, it's about profit, and it should be how many homes they have repossessed last year. Let's know. I mean, I would like to know, if I'm a shareholder of a bank, how many families they have thrown in the street last year. Mm-hmm. And for what and this is the sort of things where I think that financial reporting has to be attacked, because and once you attack it, I think you will start to know more about the companies you are investing in.
Okay, great. Let's take a few more questions then. All right, so I've got you, you, and you. So somebody in the middle right here. I'll just pass the thing along. Yeah, could say your name. And
yeah, Paul Mills. Way back, I did my doctorate on both Islamic and Christian debt thinking. But I've worked at the Treasury and the Debt Management Office for the government and the IMF, so I'm implicated all ends up. A couple of observations first. I challenge the view that certainly Christian Judaic tradition is sort of has a positive element to interest-based debt. I mean, that really only came in with the Reformation and Calvin's mistake. Before that, money lenders are in the third circle of hell. The Puritans are condemning banking even until 1640 and so on. So there isn't, apart from interest-free debt, which is hugely blessed in scripture, interest-based debt is not seen as a positive thing. The main issue about all this moral hazard point is that the biblical model is, yes, borrowers have an obligation to repay because they've given a promise, they've given their word. That's keeping their side of the relationship pure, holy, whilst the lenders have to do it without gain, interest-free, but then periodically get cancellation. So you've got this mutuality set up beforehand. Our problem with moral hazard is that we're saying debt forgiveness after the event when that was not part of the condition of the lending. So the sort of biblical framework is, yes, debt forgiveness is built in before the loan is made, and therefore you give the loan for other reasons, not to make a profit. Final observation, and perhaps sort of the main problem we've got on debt restructuring, is that most of the debt is held in leveraged balance sheets, namely banks. Therefore, if we have structural debt forgiveness now, we have banking crises, because banks are levered 40, 50, 60 times. If you write off debts without them expecting it, they're bust. And then there's cascade failure in the system. Our monetary system is gone. So before you can start saying, right, mass debt forgiveness, you've got to be very careful who's holding it, and to try and segregate off your payments mechanism from your risk-bearing credit granting side of banks. Otherwise, debt forgiveness ex post leads to banking crisis and collapse. We subsidize massively the current banking system through various covert channels. We choose to do this politically because we like cheap credit. Until we unwind that, get rid of all the tax breaks for debt, get rid of all the subsidies to banks, we ain't got a chance of doing any of this on a serious scale.
Great, thanks. So, at the back there.
I think this might take a little bit of a different turn.
Can you just tell us who you are?
I'm Sam Powell. I just completed my master's on the food aid industry and the associated advice sectors that is happening there, specifically a trust food bank. And their more than food program, which is debt, welfare, money advice. And my question was basically, is going to take it to the micro level a bit, because it seems that there's been a lot of idealist kind of textual-based analysis, and of course not with yourself, Ryan, but it seems to be this difference between what's actually playing out on the ground with Christian people volunteering and actually what biblical things say. I think there's actually a massive difference here, and I was going to actually say actually how the concepts of forgiveness perhaps play out in your context between actually the advisor and the client, and the multiple political and moral possibilities that come from these organizations, and how they internally conflict each other, perhaps through, for example, a socialist might say that he believes in individual responsibility and debt is a moral failure. So there's such a contradiction there in his own political subjectivity. So my main question really was, how do these kind of Christian concepts play out on the ground? Like forgiveness can mean forgiveness because the world is full of Satan's hate, for etc., polluting the world. Forgiveness because they do not know what they do. Forgiveness because the world is corrupt and it's not their fault. So there's many different lines of flight. So basically, it was kind of how these Christian concepts play out and intersect with other rationalities, for example, like liberal rationalities of responsibility. I wondered if you yourself have experienced this in the places you've been in. Again, okay.
very different angle.
But.
Okay, and there was... Sorry, yes.
Yeah. My name's John Watson. You'll know that I'm not an economist when I have asked the question, but... we heard mentioned just now about the idea of a tax on uninvested wealth that was just allowed to sit there. This rings a bell with me because every so often we hear an idea surfaces of the idea that you should treat money as a kind of perishable commodity, and that if you didn't spend it and use the stuff, it would just decay away like rancid butter, become unusable. So, and this is always put forward as a way of increasing volume of trade, basically. When you've got money, you've got to spend it on something else. Now, is there any way you could extend this notion of a sort of perishable money to the idea of the capital value of loans and the debt you need to repay? Could that idea be used to address this problem somehow?
Sounds good. I think there was one more up there.
Thank you. My name's Lucinda. I was thinking, we've touched on inequality. I'm thinking more of a personal sense, and maybe an inequality. One inequality is the inequality of opportunity. And it seems to me, I work for a cancer support charity, which doesn't seem very related, but it seems to me that people succeed with organizations when they have the ability to articulate their perspective well enough for it to be acted on. And actually, I think it's interesting the point you were saying about maybe the people that go to church-based places, they will be allowed to tell their story even if they do it badly. And I think that aspect of not having your voice listened to feeds into your lack of self-worth. And how do you feel your self-worth? Well, you buy something that gets you into debt. And interested, do any of you, would you agree with me that your voice, having your story heard, having your ability to articulate strengthened is a way of tackling the debt problem?
Great, thanks. We've got quite interesting, challenging questions there. So I'll open it to the panel. Anybody want to tackle this?
So just responding straight away to the last question. Certainly in the voluntary sector in the UK over the last couple of decades, I guess, as it's professionalised as a broad trend, there's been a slow and steady denigration of what's known derisively as tea and sympathy, as if that has no value. And with debt advice having become more kind of technical and problem-solving as an issue, that maybe that dimension of it has been lost, and that there are many examples of debt advice services that couple their more technical problem-solving aspect with a counselling service, and like the church-based advice services that I've worked with say that they can do something like that, and there's like an exercise of kind of empathy as well. And I fully agree that there's issues about self-worth that can counteract the sense of fault you have individually, almost inevitably, if you've got creditors hounding you. And then your question about how moral concepts play out on the ground, probably, I think... Well, I just think it's probably the same case as it is for most of us, that there are many contradictory layers and heterogeneous different moral logics kind of jostling together. So, for example, I've been exposed to anti-capitalist, homophobic, socialist, Keynesian, and so on ideas by talking to like two or three advisors in the same place, and there can be quite unusual combinations of moral and political views.
Okay. Anybody want to tackle the question of perishable debt, which I thought sounded quite interesting?
Well, there's a core economic concept, which is why governments inflated prices for years and years and years, because that was the quickest way to diminish the capital value of your debt. If you have interest, you know, if you have interest rampant increases in prices, and you owe a core amount of money, then that becomes less and less important very quickly. In times of real interest rates, which we've been in almost for the last 20 years, then real negative interest rates, then suddenly that money seems more important with time, not less. So it's traditionally done with price changes, I guess is what I'm trying to say. How you could do it as a new way of thinking about the time value of a loan is quite interesting, and I will noodle on it a bit, but governments have been real good at it for years as a way of diminishing their own debt.
Okay, any other points?
Yes, I'll talk briefly about the question of interest and usury, and let me be quite honest about this. Looking back over my notes, I realize it does sound as if this is the Christian vision that has been kind of the case throughout Christian history. I did make the point that there's a variety of views, and it is entirely true that the ban on interest was upheld for much of Christian history, and indeed there was very little kind of distinction between interest and usury. Usury was basically our interest. But I think with time, and I think it's important to look at the context, the economic context in which that ban kind of was prescribed in the Old Testament and then was upheld further on, and also the purpose behind it. And I think the economic context shows you know, in a largely agrarian economy, you don't have the kind of, as opposed to our current economy, charging interest on a loan would be a sure way of actually driving someone further into poverty. People would get into debt only in situations of distress. So I think it's important to keep in mind those differences. Today, you get into debt because you have the option to, because you're bombarded with credit marketing. You had to get into debt when your crops failed, when there's a bad harvest. So there isn't one Christian view on debt and interest that you can take off the shelf. What I ended up presenting was a mixture of the history and kind of the normative account that we went with, where we said interest is not intrinsically immoral and should be judged rather in a larger kind of framework where the emphasis is on relationships. So
I have just one comment on the question of usury, which comes from my own fieldwork in South Africa. So that was a very Calvinistic society, but as we know, sort of racist one. And there was a usury act, which was, in fact, very Calvinistic in its whole framework. And it was lifted in the 1990s, precisely at the moment where democratization came in, partly because not only was democratization coming in, but financialization suddenly became the only game in town. Everybody wanted to borrow, and the other people all wanted to lend. And so there was a perfect meeting of borrowing and lending, and the interest rate just went up, and the government stopped regulating anything. So suddenly all the moral Christian values that had sort of previously capped the interest rate were suddenly thrown out the window, because that was the only way to make money, was by lending money. So it's partly about the financialization of the economy in many of these different settings, which, and as I think we pointed out, if you don't fix those problems, you're not just going to fix the problem of debt as a sort of independent little nugget of something out there.
Yeah, but I, if I may just mention, I think our society here has to do things about mortgages, repossessing houses, and homelessness. It's really, it's just, again, the mission and addressing debts, as my dear fellow there said, it's a monumental mission required probably hundreds of years to be solved, if that even. But whatever the case, we can't have the majority of our people in this country, they have between them and to start to receive letters to be evacuated or 56 days. And the average contract is 2 or 3 months notice period, and we have children and we have families. This is something fundamentally dysfunctioning in our society, and again, just coming here and see the, I mean, well, I have to admit, I stood as a conservative candidate, and so, but I disagree with what, with all due respect to George Osborne, is not very few people, they don't want to work. The majority of people would love to work. The majority, it's not like they enjoy living on the welfare. And it's just something need the lenders. Someone has to address them that you cannot just after 56 days of the person fail to pay the mortgage, they start to bombard him, and after that to go to those bailiffs and all this nonsense and start to put stress. And so this is just, whether the solution is Islamic or Christians or agnostic, doesn't, who cares? At the end of the day, it's a human being we need to pay attention to. And the government has to do things about it, you know?
Right. Well, I think that sounds like a very good note on which to finish our discussion.
I'm just trying to share my frustration.
No, it's a very heartfelt position. So I think thank you very much to all our speakers. And if anyone wants to carry on talking, you're welcome to come and chat to them afterwards. That was great. I think it worked quite well.
Yeah.
Thank you. You do a great job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, old hand at this sort of thing.
It's easy to say we support it. It's harder for people to do it.
Quite good at it.
Oh, really?
You said it was in a no.
I mean, there were one or two of these, but they were usually on topic, so it was fine. Absolutely. I've had some crazies who just come along to everything, and they've got their own little thing to do. Once they do, thank you so much for coming. So if any of you have a moment to come and have a drink, please do.
Yes.
Thank you.
But also the morality of how it's presented. And I think that works over to individuals. That moral pestle, and then the individual, it has to be such a strong movement.
And
that's
political.
That thing changed all the people. It's also a challenge to get people to
Yeah, and I'm back.
Some that maybe some may not.